Dr. Mary Ann Mason, Esquire, is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just asking her about the connection between work, pensions, health care. There's a sort of involuntary servitude going on in here, isn't there, that you just have to work?
I ask this because this is a big problem.
Yes,
it goes to the entire way we earn our livings, but also who and what we are as a community, as a political entity.
Well, you're certainly right about that. And if you're a single mother particularly, you really, really have to take a job that will give you benefits no matter what, gives you very little choice. In this particular group that we're looking at, most of these people have partners, so they bargain. Somebody's got to have the insurance and the other one can do what they want. But you're right, it's one of the trade-offs and one of the bargains that people shouldn't have to make in life, that they have to be tied to a job just because they can't afford not to have their medical benefits. But you see this, of course, all the time with American couples.
Well, it makes it exploitive.
Yes.
Which contaminates the relationship between the employer and employee.
Yes.
And in the short term, it looks like a clever thing to do because essentially you've got a labor force that you have access to. You might have to pay them more, variety of different kinds of things.
Right.
But in the long term, by which I mean anything over 2 weeks, it seems to me that's counterproductive for everybody involved.
I agree with that.
You talk in Mothers on the Fast Track about a very specific part of the workforce and a specific part of womankind, if you will,
right,
in America.
Right.
It is interesting to watch you develop the numbers and then begin to apply it to policy, particularly within the academy, and to have this echo in two directions, both Mary Ann Mason's experience and Mary Ann Mason's daughter Eve Mason Ekman's experience as you together did this book and as your lives have been entwined, of course, as mother and daughter all the way through.
Yes.
But to me it is interesting to see the stories behind the numbers.
Yes.
Did some of this come out of the living it as well as the studying it? I mean, yes, you're an academic. You're a lawyer and an historian.
Yes. Yes.
So you have lots of skills. But that the breathing part is important too, isn't it?
Yes. And it came out of my own life, of course. I think most of us write about, on some level, the things we care about and have experienced. In my own case, growing up in the pioneer generation, there were lots of doors that were closed to begin with. And then when I did, in fact, in my second career, my first career was in academia, my second career was law, begin a career in law, I was divorced and a single mother and experienced what a lot of mothers do, that they just can't cope if they don't have a lot of support when they have small children. I didn't have any support, and I dropped out of practicing law. It's about that class of women, largely because these are the people that are my graduate students, and I have in other books written about working class women and very poor women. But in this case, I was looking at essentially the main thrust of the feminist movement was that there would be equality in the workplace. And that didn't mean that you could have as many women truck drivers as men truck drivers. That's okay too, but they were really concerned about power and power and status. And these mean going into the powerful status kinds of professions and organizations. To have that kind of power and status also means that you are making the world. You are setting the agenda for America. You are the captains of industry, you're the head of universities. You're becoming the most important political voices and public voices if you have that kind of bearing and status in the world. Women still don't have that, and without that, frankly, we're always second-class citizens. You don't hear this much anymore. You don't hear those old kind of 70s complaints that we need to be equal at all levels.
It's more than complaints. They are critiques. They are observations. And to say complaints sounds like whining, and that's not the case. This is about, as you say, and eloquently, this is about equity. It is about power. It is about what kind of a world do we want.
Yes.
It is about having voices that have not been heard. It's about perspectives for which the world is yearning and deeply in need.
Exactly.
So the ability for women to be on the fast track and not have to roll over, not have to give way on the subject of having children, is still a very important subject, even though it doesn't get talked about in this new Mamanistas yourself, Bill. This new
Mamanista.
This momism that has been very, very much supported and enhanced by some fairly radical right-wing thinkers, that women should go back to what never existed, and to roll back genuine advances, is tremendously problematical on the best day, and deeply destructive if we are not willing to say, no, that's not acceptable. Let's go back and try this again. So the notion of this new momism is one to which, if we don't stand up, there are tremendous prices to be paid.
Well, for one thing, medical schools, law schools, universities will think twice about admitting women if they're going to be leaving the workforce as they are and not fulfilling their professional goals. I wanted to write this book with my daughter because I wanted her to interview all these women of my generation and younger to get a sense of what this was all about, why it was important, these individuals, how they cope, what they fought for. One of the people she interviewed was actually one of my classmates from college, and she was the leader of the first Newsweek class action suit on the part of proofreaders and copy editors, because Newsweek had no real editors who were women. They had the copy editors, no senior writers, nothing. And they won that class action suit. It took them 3 years and a lot of grief, and they got Eleanor Norton Holmes to represent them. And at the end of that, my friend actually was made one of their first senior editors, and then she was one of the founding members of Working Women's Magazine. And they opened that door. Now, my daughter had been working in the media. She'd been working in a magazine, GQ. She didn't know that. She didn't know anything about that. But she did know, working at GQ and in the Condé Nast building and seeing all of these magazines there, almost one building, which includes the New Yorker and Harper's and all kinds of practically the most important news magazines in the world, that the lunchroom was filled with very young women who were in their 20s, usually in early 30s, and only a few older people, and those were more men than women. Those were the senior editors. So that's an industry that's built on the backs of women, always has been, young women, because they are basically worked, and then they are mostly the pyramid at the top, even in publishing, which is far more feminine-oriented in terms of its working force than others. Mostly they drop out. It's very pyramidal. And it wasn't until she started interviewing people that it occurred to her that what she was interviewing and things I had told her and things you had read actually had some relevance. Here I am. I'm one of those. I'm one of those young workers, and I'm going to get washed out, and do I want this to be washed out, etc. It made her really reflective and think about it. So, among other things, if I made her think about it, I hope that I'll make other young women and their mothers and their fathers and other young men, because, in fact, we really can't do, we can't change a workplace. We really can't change any of these institutions unless young fathers also get involved. This is a parental issue. If it's only women who take the flexible leave, ultimately that will die. At California, the University of California, we put in place substantial changes for parenthood and mothering and fathering so that men and women get a year off their clock, their tenure clock, if they have a child. In the case of childbirth, women get 2 semesters without teaching, but men get 1. And men are starting to take this, which makes them enthusiastic rather than critical or just sometimes downright envious that, you know, women can get this time off and they can't. It's been
Why do you say men have to do this for women to succeed at it?
Because if there is basically a mommy track, a part-time track that only women take, then it becomes fast marginalized. And women who are on this mommy track will not be taken as seriously when they come up for tenure or promotion or whatever. It's really important that both the company buys into it, Deloitte and Touche did, but men buy into it as well and participate as well. Now, nothing in life is ever totally equal, so there might be my turn, your turn, and it's not necessary that everybody has to do exactly the same thing, but there has to be a notion that this is, you know, participation by all. No one says, I think, in a workplace, well, I'm not going to pay my sick insurance because I never get sick, and I'm very angry that Joe Smith gets sick. You pay it because you know that you might get sick as well. You pay it for the good of everyone, for the general well-being. And this is similar to any kind of parental leave. A lot of people are not necessarily parents, and I think particularly the older generation of women who didn't have children sometimes very much resent these parental modifications, and men do too. So if it has to be something that people fully participate in, or at least understand why the participation is important for a healthy and creative workforce.
I found myself examining the notion of fast track. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? What are the underlying values? What are the assumptions that go with it? And the track, of course, is very linear.
Yes, exactly.
And it does have a race that somebody wins and somebody loses.
That's right.
Well, I'm really thinking, I mean, I think the railroad track.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me at least is a stereotype, at least in my mind, which is linear and doesn't allow for deviations. And it occurs to me, particularly in the case of university, which is for a long time recognized the importance of sabbaticals.
Yes.
As a way of stepping back,
exactly.
Refreshing the gene pool of, you know, your mind, or, you know, just stopping. Just,
yes.
Just to take a deep,
yes,
breath of air, maybe look at things a little bit differently.
Yes.
That same process is equally important in anything that requires the kind of imagination and thinking and skill that is compatible with the degree of education.
Yes.
The reason we've educated these people is we, you know, presumably these are not just trade schools. We, you know, we really want people to be to have a broad view of the world around them. And if you're locked on that track, and you're, all you see day after day after day is, you know, what's directly in front of,
yes,
you. You get stale, you become,
yes,
unimaginative, you let things go by, you get in a rut, all those kinds of negative things. And it would seem that this greed aside,
yes,
which is a big part of the challenge.
And universities are not supposed to be greedy, right?
Yes. Economics aside, which is not irrelevant,
right.
Obviously. I mean, it obviously is a central driver in this. But that aside, the importance of just refreshing the system would seem to be essential to all these professions.
Yes.
What you talk about.
And the reason he's talking about the fast track is that Mary Ann Mason and her daughter Eve Mason Ekman have written Mothers on the Fast Track, How a New Generation Can Balance Family and Careers. The three of us will be back in just a moment. Be with us when we return.